My name is Lilia, and I'm here with my friend Caitlin.
Hello.
Yeah, Caitlin is my friend, but most importantly, my coworker.
For the next 6 hours.
Yeah, for the next 6 hours, because our contract is up tomorrow.
Woohoo!
As of the day we're recording this, Monday, yeah. May 1st.
Yes.
And the contract is up May 2nd.
Yeah,
which is tomorrow. But by the time you hear this, we will sadly no longer be coworkers.
But we'll just be friends.
Yeah. Oh, so sad.
Bummer.
And we're coming live from the music building basement. Except not live, because I'm going to edit this. We are in the music
basement.
We're
coming from the music building basement.
Yeah, but when you hear this, we won't be there
anymore. We won't be there. Well, I don't know. Maybe we will.
You know, maybe we could be. I probably will be, because I'm here all the time.
So fair.
You might be.
I might be. Maybe. I'm here, like, on Tuesdays and Thursdays.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you're not, like, intruding.
Yeah.
Speaking of intruding, what are we talking about today?
We're going to talk about deviance, the social construction of it, and how it contributes to moral panics through the ages.
What a great topic.
I know.
Yeah, some light listening on social deviance for your whatever day you're listening this on. I'll just say for your Monday, because that's the day we're recording it on.
So you should listen to this on a Monday. So, what do you think about deviance, and what does it mean?
I think it's very difficult to define what deviance is. I mean, overall, it's basically any, like, set of behaviors that we as a society see as not conforming to our social norms.
Yeah.
And that's a really broad definition, and obviously that's going to change over time, because what we consider to be normal is socially constructed.
Yeah.
So that means anything that deviates from that is also going to be socially constructed. But just because it's deviant doesn't necessarily mean it's bad.
Okay, so for deviance, why do you think it exists? I mean, to me, I think to enforce social norms, you have to, there must exist an opposite, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, there's different, like, depending on which school of thought you're talking about, there's, like, different reasons for why people are deviant. Like, one reason, like, one kind of school of thought, which is going along the lines of, like, every part of society exists for a purpose. So, like, every part of society has a purpose, and they all have to work together to make society function.
Gotcha.
So if we're going by that, then deviance exists in order to strengthen social norms, because the way a community of people reacts to something deviant will strengthen their, like, it will strengthen their bond, and it will strengthen what they think the social norm is.
Yeah.
By defining what a social norm is not, you can define what it is. Basically.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was thinking. Like, in order for it to really exist, there has to be an opposite. If that makes sense, you can say something is right and something is wrong, because it's hard to be like, this is right, without defining necessarily what is wrong.
Yeah. And you, like I was saying, like, when people, you know, when someone's behaving in a way that is deviant, the way the rest of society reacts to it kind of, like, strengthens their own bond. And also, when this was interesting, and part of what he was saying was also that deviance is good because the people who generally propel social change are considered deviants, like, in the context of their own society. And that's why we need people to, like, be deviant, because if we don't, then nothing's going to change.
Yeah.
Which is very interesting.
So, the next thing I want to ask you about and talk about is, how does society view deviance, and then how does it attempt to get rid of it, and how does that impact personal liberty? I know that's a lot, but...
Well, we've done a lot as a society, and when I say we, I obviously mean society, like, at large. Like, we're not individually doing this, but what we do a lot is, whenever we don't like something, we tend to pass laws banning it. So, like, there's this thing, it's called the ugly laws, and it sounds so fake, but it was an actual thing that happened. They weren't actually called the ugly laws. It was basically a series of, like, laws and legal codes that were meant to curtail panhandling and begging and all that stuff, but what they ended up doing was criminalizing, like, quote-unquote, maimed, disheveled, unsightly people from being in public, and they would impose a fine on people like that if they were allegedly creating a nuisance, which sounds super vague, and that's the point. Because as you'll see, Vague language is very useful because you can make it mean whatever you want.
Yeah, we really like to do that in America.
We love vague language. But yeah, no, this was in place. I think they were starting getting passed in like the mid to late 1800s. And then they, most of them got repealed in the 70s. Like the 1970s, to be clear, not the 1870s. Yeah. So they were in place for like a long time. And what they ended up doing is they basically ended up removing disabled people from the public sphere. Because that's who the laws ended up targeting, and because, especially at the time, being disabled in public was considered a deviant behavior. So it ended up basically criminalizing being disabled in public. Or, like, talking about driving while black, walking while black, which is, like, it might not be, an official express coded language, an expressed, like, legal code. But it is, like, a different treatment you receive when you are driving while black or walking while black. And there was a law that got repealed in New York recently that was colloquially known as the walking while trans law. Mm. And it basically did a lot of the same stuff that, the ugly laws did, where it would basically criminalize you for vaguely cross-dressing.
Oh, you know what the first laws you were talking about reminded me of is, even though they were repealed in the 70s, it kind of reminds me of like the broken windows laws that Rudy Giuliani introduced around the 1990s.
Yeah.
With this idea of like harsh punishments for minor crimes because he wanted to deter bigger crimes from happening in the end. The whole broken windows thing, what that means is he said, like, if you were walking by a building with broken windows, there's not much stopping you from picking up a rock and breaking another. Mm-hmm. But if they go out and they repair all the windows, then you're not going to want to throw a rock at the building because none of the windows are broken.
That is an interesting logic. That is an interesting way to think.
I was going to say, I feel like I'm not explaining it well enough. But, yeah, but the idea, though, is also this led to a lot of, like, disproportionately affecting, like, minorities and stuff, which also kind of ties into, like, the walking while black idea, because I think you can also tie this into, like, stop and frisk laws,
mm-hmm.
And that kind of thing, and just, like, minorities being, you know, disproportionately affected and more harshly treated for mm-hmm. minor things, like, even non-offenses, mm-hmm. and also just for minor offenses in general, because this idea was that coming down hard on things, like, you know when you go to cities and, like, a bunch of people will come up and try to wash your car and get mm-hmm. money from you? Like, if you come down hard on that, the idea is that they won't become, like, hardened criminals, because they're always, like, teenagers,
mm-hmm.
but also, like, that's not necessarily, like, the worst offense ever. Maybe that's my opinion, but, like, I just don't think that's, like, the worst thing ever to, like, really come down hard on someone.
Yeah, no, that's, like, basically what the idea of walking while black was going about, is that, like, yes, jaywalking is a crime. Crossing the crosswalk when the light is blinking, or like when the red hand is up and not the walking guy. Like, yeah, that's technically a crime, but
no one's
really gonna arrest you for it.
Yeah,
where it's like they're like black people like more likely to be ticketed or arrested for things that, like, yes, they were crimes, but they weren't something that a white person would have been stopped for in the name of deterring overall crime. And what this kind of connects to is another way that people, like, tend to define what is deviant and, like, who is considered a deviant is what is called labeling theory. That's kind of another, like, it's a very broad idea, but it's basically saying that no behavior and no person is inherently deviant, but we as a society label certain behaviors or certain people as deviant, and that kind of sets the process in motion. Like with the crosswalk, like we all cross the crosswalk when we're technically not supposed to, but we're not all labeled criminals. It's certain people that are labeled criminals, and like how and who we label as a criminal matters a lot. And it's very, like, socially constructed.
But, yeah. That is true, because when you think about it, too, the idea of enforcing these, like, cross-dressing mm-hmm. laws, like, let's be real, if I walk out on the street wearing a men's polo, I'm not going to get arrested for it,
mm-hmm.
you know? But a trans person may get arrested under the same law for no other reason than that they're trans. It's the vague language.
No, that was the whole thing about the drag ban in Tennessee recently, where they simultaneously defined... They banned drag in public spaces, or, like, where kids could see it, while simultaneously making the definition of drag be so vague. They put drag under the umbrella of, like, acts that were done with, like, prurient interests, which is, like, I guess, like, 18-plus interests, basically. Yeah, so it was, like, along the lines of, like, stripping and, like, sex work. So they kind of grouped them all under the same umbrella, and then they banned them in places where there could be kids.
Yeah.
But then it's, like, that's pretty vague. Like, what are we defining as, like, cross-dressing? Yeah. What are we defining as drag? That's kind of vague, man. Yeah. It's almost like it could be applied to people with no intention of doing drag. People who have no intention of being sexy, who are just in public.
But what it all goes back to, I guess, in the end, is that our definition of what is deviant is evolving very much.
Yeah.
And, I mean, yes, it is shifting away from things that were previously considered deviant. Like, we're normalizing a lot of things.
That's
like,
true.
Things that should be normalized, like getting gay married. Yeah. That was a crazy thing, honestly, even 10 years ago. Because I think, didn't it get passed in, like, 2015? Like,
It was on the table starting in, like, 2012, but it didn't actually get passed until 2015.
Yeah, exactly. So, like, 15 years ago, getting gay married was a normal, or same-sex marriage. Same-sex marriage.
Gay marriage. Same-sex marriage was considered a deviant act,
Yeah, but now that the law provides the same protections, or at least mostly the same protections for same-sex couples as it does for, like, heterosexual couples, and with the added, like, representation in different types of media, and with support from a lot of different parts of our society, it's seen as more normal.
And for all the faults of rainbow capitalism, I do think it normalizes being queer in some way.
Agreed.
Because for all of the, like, issues with it, at least the companies are, like, seeing that that's where the money is.
You know what this all reminds me of, actually, is I read this, like, blog post once about a person and their take on rainbow capitalism, because before all I'd ever seen was, it's bad, but they wrote something very beautiful about, it was an older person from the LGBTQ plus community, and they wrote about how at the time, you know, they were having pride parades, and it was considered deviant, you know, it wasn't normalized. So to have a company appear at a pride parade, to have a company have a booth at a pride celebration, that was such a powerful act of deviance by them, because they were not going to be, you know, like, respected for that in the grand scheme of society. But it was a way that these people were able to know, having a company have something at pride or show, have pride products, that was a way that they knew they were welcome in these stores at a time where they weren't sure if they were. So, like, I don't remember the exact companies. I do remember Target being one, but I don't think it was one of the earliest ones. It was, like, a later one. But I remember them saying, like, I saw Target at the Pride Parade. That meant I knew I could shop at Target with my partner. And I knew that they, like, supported my interests. And that was, like, they were putting it out on the line. So I think rainbow capitalism has, yes, gotten to a point where there are a lot of really valid criticisms, but I think it's important to look at where it kind of started out with companies actually just standing by a community.
No, but with rainbow capitalism, like, we've reached a point, as you were saying with Target, like, where people are, like, expecting quality pride merch from Target, because I think last year their pride merch was, like, unusually well done. I guess people kind of got used to expecting just, like, really kind of bad quality, like, rainbow flag, a rainbow flag on a t-shirt, hashtag gay on a t-shirt, and then the companies were just, like, calling it a day. But Target had very well thought out pride merch that had, like, it had, like, funky art styles and, like, subtle patterns. And I've already seen people ranking this year's pride merch. But as we were saying, one of the ways we're redefining what is considered deviant is, like, when companies do rainbow capitalism, which is basically when large companies market themselves as being gay-friendly, and they use, like, rainbow flag imagery, but usually they tend to only use it during June. Like, they'll change their profile pictures to, like, with their logo, but with the gay flag, or they'll release, like, a line of gay items. Like, Target had, like, gay wine,
and gay Prosecco.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was like canned wine, but in a rainbow can, and it was the gay wine. Yeah, but it's like only during June, and it's very like surface level generally. They might not actually do a lot of stuff, or they might commit gross human rights violations in their companies, but at least the can of the Coca-Cola is rainbow. But the mere existence of rainbow capitalism means that it's no longer deviant to support the gay community or the LGBT community.
Yeah, it's almost becoming, like, the norm. I mean, I'm hesitant to say this as someone who's from a very, like, liberal area and goes to college, and college is kind of known for being, like, a more liberal community. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, I feel like, in a way, it's kind of more deviant, in at least the circles I am, to be, like, I'm homophobic. I feel like the default is kind of, like, being supportive. Maybe not being, like, hardcore ally, gonna mm-hmm. be at the Pride Parade, but, like, yeah, whatever. Like, live your life kind of vibes, you know?
Yeah. But I think it is an example of, like, how different communities have redefined what it means to be deviant.
Yeah.
Not necessarily that maybe that is the case for all of America, obviously, but in, like, this, our micro communities, it is deviant to say, I don't like gay people, or to say, like, keep that to yourself. And the way we react to it builds our bonds as people who are not homophobic.
Yeah, that is true, because that really goes on to the idea that deviance, we talked about it earlier, is so subjective.
Mm-hmm.
It's so, like, there's social norms, but you're right, it can go into, like, your small subcultures mm-hmm. and communities, and you're right, and I feel like both of us probably run in circles where being homophobic is deviant.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, sometimes, dare I say, that's a good thing.
Yeah. Sometimes, maybe things should be considered deviant.
Maybe.
Yeah. But, like, I feel like, in a way, because, like, also, I would say in my circles, mm-hmm. like, committing crimes is considered deviant.
I feel, like, there are some norms that are more universal than others, but also, I feel like a lot of crime is also very subjective.
Yeah.
Because, like, with the example of stealing, like, yes, it is breaking a law, but the reason it's you're being deviant may not be for malicious purposes, because maybe you're stealing because you know, screw society, but more than likely you're stealing because you need food or you need money, and you that's the only way you can think of to get it, which is not in and of itself a malicious purpose, but you are going against how society expects you to get food and to get money. And that's what a lot of conflict theory says about deviance, is that it's created by, basically, in the, like, the struggle for power, and that it's created because people need to survive because of structural inequality.
Yeah.
A lot of interesting stuff there.
So, I know we've covered a lot about deviance today, so how do you think deviance fuels moral panics in society?
Well, first, I feel like we should, like, define what a moral panic is. Basically, moral panics are created, like, as a broad definition, that's kind of, like, a simplified way of explaining it. A lot of times they're created because there's a group of people who, is conflicting with society's norms in a way that is perceived to be damaging to society. They're a danger to society as we know it, and that's where the panic comes in. A lot of, like, the school of thought on moral panics comes from this guy named Stan Cohen. He studied, like, subcultures in Britain. Like, specifically, he studied clashes between youth subcultures mm-hmm. in Great Britain, and how the media portrayed those clashes.
Mm-hmm.
And basically what he came up with is that the media helped fuel a moral panic by exaggerating or sometimes misrepresenting those, like, intra-community clashes, and kind of by painting, like, young people as, like, the deviant group and as, like, the danger to society. And honestly, I feel like we do that a lot. I feel like a lot of times, whatever the young people are doing, subculture or not, we kind of paint that as, like, oh, kids these days, they're damaging society. Kids these days aren't buying diamonds like they used to.
Yeah.
Kids these days are crumbling the restaurant industry because they're not eating out as much. But that was very interesting, because he was also talking about how the media plays into it.
And what that reminded me of was the panic of the day, if you will, is, like, the existence of trans people has created a bit of a moral panic in society. But it reminded me of, like, the controversy of trans people playing sports.
Yeah.
For those of you not in the know, the controversy of the day is that trans people, specifically trans women who are athletes, are getting a lot of flack and a lot of, like, gaining a lot of controversy for doing sports, especially when they place in a sport. But the way the media is reporting on it is kind of whack. Recently, in the London Marathon, there was this lady, this trans lady, who was in the marathon, basically. That's what she did. So she was in the London Marathon. And if you Google trans woman London Marathon to try to figure out what's going on, you get two types of headlines. You get trans runner beats 14,000 women, and you get trans marathoner places 6,159th.
Yeah.
So when you report that, like, someone beat 14,000 women, that's like, oh my god, she beat 14,000 women in competition.
Yeah.
But in reality, she lost to 6,000 other women.
Yeah.
So the way that it's been reported on is very misleading. And honestly, like, in my opinion, this is the kind of stuff that Stan was talking about.
So that's definitely a moral panic that's going on now, but yeah, it's very reminiscent of, we've had a lot of moral panics in the past, especially ones to do with family values.
Which, oh, yes.
We're going to go back in time a little bit, oh, one yes, step back to should. The satanic panic.
Oh my god. Basically, the satanic panic was like a period of time in the 70s and 80s, kind of bleeding into the 90s, where there was a lot of paranoia about the influence of devil worshippers
yeah.
on society, especially on children, like the influence of devil influencers and Satanists on children. And I was trying to, like, I was doing some, like, background research trying to figure out why this was happening now, because whenever something happens, I'm like, why did that happen?
Yeah.
What caused it to happen? And I think it's really interesting because it was shortly after the Vietnam War ended. It was during a time when there were a lot of horror movies were becoming popular.
Mm-hmm.
And it was also, it overlapped a lot with what is known as the Golden Age of Serial Murder, which is basically the time when all the serial killers were serial killing.
Yeah.
Because if you think about it, like, a lot of the household names, like Jeffrey Dahmer or Ted Bundy,
yeah,
they were active in the 70s and, like, 80s.
Yeah.
And that was really interesting. And that was a rabbit hole I went down, because I was like, why did that happen? Why was this golden age of serial murder happening at this point in time?
Yeah.
And that was apparently, well, there's a lot of, like, debate about it. One of the prevailing theories is that a lot of the serial murderers during this time were kids of fathers who were heavily traumatized by the Vietnam War, and, like, the family dysfunction that caused, like, made them more predisposed to become serial murderers. Like, it might have exacerbated any other, like,
yeah,
underlying issues they might have had. And also, a lot of, like, the law enforcement technology was getting better, so they were, like, they had more tools to identify murderers.
Yeah.
And identify crime. I guess it was a little bit of confirmation bias, because yeah, they started identifying that there was more crime, and so it seemed like there was more crime. But this was also coincidentally a time when a lot of, like, cults and high control groups were getting popularized, and that was, like, a big storm of panic surrounding the attack on family values
yeah,
by devil worshippers and Satanists. Also, going back to the law enforcement, law enforcement had just recently started, like, prosecuting crimes against children more harshly.
Mm-hmm.
And so the rise of daycares, like, daycares also started becoming more popular at this time.
Gotcha.
And that, those two things happening at the same time made people more paranoid about crimes against children.
Gotcha.
And so a lot of that was tied into devil worshippers. But a lot of it, honestly, a lot of it, I feel like, stays in our society, because this was also coincidentally a time when the Christian right was being formed.
So, like, all this stuff was happening in the 70s and 80s. You had the golden age of serial killers. You had horror movies. You had the end of the Vietnam War. You had just finished the 60s. You just finished with the, like, massive civil rights movement, which was a huge change to society. I would argue for good, but it was a change nevertheless. You had better... You had more awareness of crime in general. And you had the rise of the Christian right. Or, like, you had the rise of the moral majority. Because the 80s is when Ronald Reagan got elected.
Yeah.
And that really helped solidify, like, the Christian Americans as, a right-wing voter bloc.
Yeah.
So you had all this happening that kind of culminated in, paranoia about attacks on Christianity and attacks on family values. And even though, like, the actual devil-worshipping part has since faded away, we're still retaining a lot of that, oh, this is an attack on society, as in this is an attack on, like, social norms, so therefore it's bad mentality into, like, the moral panics we're having now. And I think that a lot of it does have to do with, like, the increased prominence that Christianity has had since that time.
I want to go off of some of what we talked about in the Satanic Panic and tie it a little bit to now times as well. Is the thing about protecting children is, I think, used a lot to justify of these moral panics, because obviously the grand majority of people want to protect children, obviously. And I've seen it a lot recently, too, with there was a state that was passing laws that were against, like, cross-dressing and against that and considering that a sexual crime. Mm-hmm. And then also now raising the punishment for sexual crimes against children to, like, death penalty levels. So people saying that's going to be applied in a really negative way to, like, transgender and gender non-conforming individuals, which I thought was... very concerning.
That, yeah, pretty concerning. Yeah. No, and a lot of the, like, rhetoric used against, like, queer people and gay people and trans people is, like, painting them as predators against children. A lot of the time, the well-being of children is used as an excuse to spread misinformation about groups of people or about behaviors. I think the reason that the well-being of children is used as a way to spread hate speech and misinformation is because it's such a universal, like, positive thing. Like, you
can't say
that you're against helping children without seeming like a horrible person.
Yeah.
And, like, don't you want the children to be safe? Like, yeah, obviously everybody wants, no one wants children to be harmed. Everybody wants children to be safe. But it's being used as, like, a vehicle.
Yeah,
like a Trojan horse. As a Trojan horse to, like, spread anti-gay, anti-trans, like, conspiracy theories, basically.
Yeah, it's used because it's so universally appealing.
Yeah.
Yeah,
because it's,
everyone wants to help the children, but it just depends on who you ask what the best way to help the children is.
No, there's so much we could go into about, like, who gets to decide what morality is and, like, how we define morality, who defines morality, what happens when that changes more specifically. But I think we'll have to cut it here.
Yeah.
So moral of the story is, we live in a society
with deviance.
With deviance and social norms. And sometimes those social norms change.
Yeah. And then that makes who is deviant change too.
It does.
We really do be living in a society.
We really do live in a society. Thank you for tuning in to this episode of the podcast, which I believe is called Creative Insights Podcast. We were really creative.
We were. And we had so many insights.
We did have so many insights. Lillian and Caitlin signing off from the Music Building basement.